Yeah, it says 1, 2, 3. Yeah, it's fast. So, yeah. Okay, sure. Bye.
That this is the opportunity for all members to ask their questions and not only provide insight as it is possible, but get the information from the minister himself as well, because the minister is hands-on with the portfolio and things like that. So the information that she has, that she provides to the portfolio committee, is also quite important. And I absolutely support your notion that all committee members need to be given equal opportunity to ask the questions that they need to be asked, and that no one member should ask so many questions that it prevents another portfolio committee's right to ask a question. But at the same time, I don't want the number of questions to be limited, which is why in two meetings prior, I asked for more committee meetings to be set up so that we have enough time in each committee meeting to deal with the subject at hand in particular. So those almost 50 questions that I might have had, or that other committee members might have in future, I think that we should ensure that the committee has enough time to deal with all those, but at your discretion, Chair, you will then say, okay, member, you've exhausted your time, as you have done with me in the past, and you said, okay, Honourable Danda, it's time to give someone else a chance, but so long as then I am given, or another member is then given still the opportunity to complete their questions, and then we just ensure that we have enough time in committee to deal with them. Thank you,
Jay. Honourable Member, I'm going to thank you, Stana.
No, thank you much, I think your articulation on that matter is quite in order. I think we welcome that. It's a step in the right direction. Because in my view, in as much as we have not discussed the matter per se, but it defeats the entire purpose. And I don't want to repeat what they have said. It will not be then proper that we have a situation by other members, their time is not their time, but they are already covered. The questions are exhausted before one reaches. So it will be important that the question of self-limitation is at the end, so that we don't disturb the meeting by calling for order. That's why we never call the meeting for order. But for me, it's time is intervention on the part of the chair that we should really be mindful of the fact that we are part of the portfolio committee where we should all participate. So those notions, I agree, it cannot be justified. But I think we have acted with caution not to disrupt meetings for order and so forth. So very order, thanks very much, and I hope and trust this matter will be adhered to and will respect it.
Any other interventions, Bonomi? Sorry, Honourable Bonomi.
Doctor, I totally agree with you, but you have to treat the officials equally and ensure that the cash question is thrown at them. Like, to me, it seems that can see as an abuse of the members there, of the officials. So I think we must take that in mind. And it's quite asking questions, I throw you questions like right and center at them. At the same time, you must consider the officials too, that they're not machines. And they can't just rattle everything off without having time, and they have to study the questions and understand the questions. So I agree with you totally.
No, thanks. I think the minimum has raised the issue, this in good spirit of making sure that all of us were on the same wavelength in terms of functioning. And we understand how to be able to approach issues of questions and all of that. But be that as it may, I want to say that sometimes you may find that because you normally get the very long presentations and all of that, and you may have to want to input on each and everything that you feel important that you need to be clarified on. And as a result, you find yourself having to have a number of questions or whatever input that we want to make and all of that. But I think I agree with you in the spirit that in an event that a member of that wants to raise those questions, I agree with you in total that maybe at some point when we're alone, we'll then be able to deal with those questions that needs to be covered sufficiently. But I think the spirit in which we have raised it, I think it must be understood within that particular context.
See, I get worried when the ERF addresses me. As a summarizer note, with...
I think there are two dimensions. One, as you read it, and all of us generally agree. As you said, we're not limiting anyone from raising questions, but if people have many questions, some will fall outside the portfolio committee meeting. They've got a right to interact with the department and so on and so forth, the minister, to feed those answers. And within the portfolio committee time, we need to manage that, and we rely on you to be flexible and deal with that situation as and when it comes, looking into the program of the day and so on. And the second dimension is on members who prefer to raise questions in advance for a program or an aspect that is still to come. At times, we having agreed that we put in this particular matter in advance until another day, but you find members raising questions in that regard. And my understanding will be that we may not want to entertain that until such a matter has been put before us and we're able to entertain it as a whole. Because then it also still defeats the verdict. We have got questions already in the bag, and when the government goes back to prepare and still come back to us, and questions have been asked already. And on the date, we're just coming to be listening to answers for a particular member, and not all members are going to interact equally. Like. So I'm saying where there is a need, you are within your powers to say a member may ask 3, 4 questions or 5, whatever the number that you put forward. But when questions are exhausted, another member may not have other questions, and we have spent equitable time to members. You can still allow members to have additional bite and so on. I don't think we may deliver this point beyond that. But I just wanted to emphasize the latter dimension that I've just put forward.
I think we were in agreement that we are not making any limitations to the number of questions that colleagues can ask. We are also saying we must then do our self-limiting, because we want this committee to work as a committee so that everybody has the opportunity to ask questions. But also, I think Honorable Bonhomme is correct. If we ask many questions, we might also not get good replies because they might not have prepared for those questions. But I think I was just raising it in the spirit, colleagues, that we look at ourselves, how we conduct our own business, but we are here on behalf of our people, by the way. That's first and foremost. And whatever it is that we do it in the hope that that will improve the life of our people. That is the guiding principle, and nothing else. Nothing else should be the guiding principle. But I think we are in agreement on this issue. If there are other discussions that we'll take, we might take them at our own time during a committee session alone when we're not with the department. But thanks for how we have all responded to this intervention from the chair. And indeed, we couldn't have responded in any other way because we are honorable members. So there's no other way we could have responded to this one. Colleagues, thank you very much. Can we now get to the... Colleagues will remember that The last time we got a presentation from the department on the applications that they've received for, from companies for the department to postpone the adherence of those companies to the, our Air Quality Act, we requested the department to go back and come with a reader-friendly presentation. You see, we don't have doctorates in nuclear and physics and whatnot. So, so that's why we sent you back, but it was a request that you yourself made, that you go back and come to us. But don't only stick to the postponement, stick to the principles that are embodied in the work that we want to do. We know, colleagues, but by the way, we went to, last year we had a report that is before this call, thank you to Parliament now, a report that speaks about air pollution in our air pollution hotspots. It is within that ambit that we then requested you to come and tell us how are we doing broadly in that area. But linked to that, we know that there have been allocations, and those allocations fall within the ambit of this work that we did last year. The visit that we undertook, the interaction we had with the very same companies that some are applying for postponement of the adherence to the Act. What is your take? And broadly, will such postponement have an effect on the air quality in those areas where those companies are applying? So we thank you very much, all of your DG and your team. That is the first item. We will now allow you to speak.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Good morning. The presentation, very front page, is Dr. Tudium Luli, but I'm going to do the presentation. This is going to be a sharing of the input. Also, Chair, because...
Before you continue, I hope all of us have the presentation. Decisions on applications for performance of compliance time frames, Air Quality Act. Okay. If we have that, that's what the presenter will be speaking to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Just to say, also because this is quite a technical area, and I too do not necessarily have a PhD in air quality management. However, Dr. Tulin Luli does have a PhD. So we have to share this responsibility in a manner that enables the doctor to bring the technical elements. And I can then bring the policy elements. And the DG can help us out when we're in trouble, DG. thank you, Chair. So as you've requested, we're going to do some contextual inputs on where we've come with the legislation over time and what is the objective of the Air Quality Act and how it sets us up for this work on postponement applications, measuring and monitoring the compliance of industry with the minimum emission standards that are set out in Section 21. I will not necessarily go through all of the contextual slides because some of these have been presented before, but it's always useful just to have a mental reminder of some of the key issues. So as we will recall, the Atmospheric Pollution Prevention Act of 1965 really to some extent, yes, it was the start of the work on managing our air pollution emissions. However, it was quite responsible for, it was quite responsible to some extent for the fact that we now have air pollution hotspots. Because it was source-based, it was really only monitoring what was coming out of the pipe, what was coming out of the stack in the case of air quality. So when we moved into the National Environmental Management Air Quality Act in 2004-2005, it really represented a very important shift from what was exclusively at that time a source-based air pollution control system to a much more integrated and holistic approach, which recognized that an airshed, like a watershed, is affected by multiple different sources of air pollution, and that when you accumulate all of those sources of air pollution, you end up with an airshed or with an area which is in trouble because of those cumulative multiple sources. And often airsheds are influenced by your physical environment. So, for example, mountains on one side can limit an airshed and can affect the manner that air currents operate in a particular airshed. So the UCCRAT focuses on the adverse impacts of air pollution on the ambient air environment. And ambient really just simply refers to the air that we are breathing. It's that air that right now we are in breathing, and if there was a smoker in this room, our ambient environment would have been affected by the smoker. It sets standards for pollutant levels in ambient air. It also sets emission standards to minimize the amount of pollution that goes into that ambient air. I won't go into detail on this, it just reminds us of the overall objectives of the National Air Quality Act. What's critical is the Act actually defines air quality that is not harmful to health and well-being. So that's a very direct link with Section 24 of the Constitution, and therefore represents what constitutes acceptable levels of pollution beyond which people are starting to be deprived or are being deprived of their Section 24 rights. Now, I'm going to be talking to the presentation and also talking to the document that was presented to members, because there are some cases in which there's more detail in the document, and I will refer you to the page number. But just to say that here what we have is examples of what are the ambient air quality standards for sulfur dioxide at the top, for nitrogen dioxide in the middle, and for particulate matter. Now, these standards, you see that they have different averaging periods. It's a standard over a 10-minute period, over a 1-hour period, over a 24-hour period, and over a 1-year period. And this is important because it informs the kind of monitoring that is being done and that needs to be done in order to give us a full picture of what the situation is in that particular airshed, or how the ambient air is reacting to a particular situation. For example, a company may suddenly have a problem in which it is releasing a huge amount of emissions on a particular day, but those emissions over time will be distributed further and further, and the airshed will over time get into a better quality. So it enables us to really understand over different periods of time what the status and quality of air is in that particular airshed or area. Just to then remind us also that the Act has multiple different instruments to enable us to manage this very complicated source of pollution. It requires air quality management plans to be done by provinces, by municipalities, and just very quickly remind us that there's from a province, metro, district, and local perspective, we are monitoring the extent to which those air quality management plans are in place or are not in place. So that just gives you a sense of how we are doing from a provincial perspective, from a metro, 5 out of 8. Maybe you'll help me there.
Probably we have minus less than 8.
Okay, Honourable, now you're going into the political and the technical, and I'm out of my depth. Okay, and there is the purpose of the air quality management plans, why we need those plans, to identify what all the forces are, to develop the baseline report, so that we are able to monitor against that baseline report how we are doing, set those air quality management objectives, what actually do we want, what is the desired state, in that province, identify the resources required to get that to the desired state. So putting in place a real operational management plan that has clear targets, clear objectives, and a plan with attached necessary resources. We know about the national air quality priority areas that the Minister has established. I'm not going to go into any of these. And what is required for those priority areas, but it has to have an air quality management plan. We know the three that have been identified, and there's a very quick geographic depiction of where those are. And here is just a snapshot of the complexity with which we are dealing, because in a particular priority area, whether it is the Vaal, whether it is the Huisveld, whether it is Waterberg, Watanala, there are different sources depending on what is happening within that priority area. There's domestic burning in the very highly populated areas, particularly coal burning. There's dust and emissions from mining operations. There's the industrial emissions, and that's what we're going to get to today, in particular the industrial emissions. There's vehicle emissions, and we need to deal with each of these different sources of emissions in different ways. And that really is where the complexity of it comes in, because we need different instruments to manage these different sources. In the context of domestic coal burning, for example, in particular, which happens in our low-income and very dense human settlement areas, it's not easy to manage. We've got to quantify it, we've got to understand it, and what we are doing, and we've just had a discussion earlier this week with the social cluster of DGs about a strategy for how you deal with air pollution in low-income and settlement areas. And it requires the Department of Energy, it requires the Department of Transport, it requires the Department of Human Settlements to help us with the multiple sources of air pollution, even within that particular area, because it's not only that people are burning coal to keep themselves warm, burning coal to cook with, and it's also that in those areas there are unpaved roads, for example, dust, terrible dust, and there are also industries situated often, because of our apartheid legislation, often industries situated right close to those low-income areas. There's often also a challenge of traffic, for example, using not only dirt roads but also emitting from vehicles that may not be the brand new vehicles. They are vehicles that are older. They are vehicles that people may not necessarily have sufficient income in order to actually service those vehicles. They're pumping out a lot of fumes. We've got the dust control regulations, which is a particular area in the mining context. We've got the industrial emissions, which we will be dealing with today, and the vehicle emission strategy. Now, if we just talk about the regulation of industrial facilities, this is Section 21 of the Air Quality Act, which requires the minister to publish a list of activities which result in atmospheric emissions, and to establish minimum emission standards in respect of a substance or a mixture of substances resulting from those listed activities. Now, the critical thing here is that the 1965 Atmospheric Pollution Prevention Act only dealt with particulate matter, and not only have we shifted from a source base to an environment base and cumulative approach, but we also are dealing now with not only particulate matter, we're also dealing with sulfur dioxide and NOx. I'm now going to refer you to page four of the document, the memo, Chair, the notes. So we have in addition to the presentation, we have a narrative document, which is a 27-page narrative document, and which goes in some additional detail.
Can you just get that board member that it's the discussion to report on decisions made regarding applications?
Yes.
Yep.
And page four of that document had a list of tables in it, slightly raised fuzzy tables. And it says, subcategory 1.2, liquid fuel combustion installations, subcategory 1.3, solid biomass combustion installations, and subcategory 1.4, gas combustion installations. Now this is an extract. It looks like this. No, is that...
Page 4.
There was an additional... Yes. It has some gray tables on it. It's an updated version. Apologies for that. Yes.
I believe and we make sure that all members have this information that we need now with the tables, and we will deal with the other issues later. Just this information with the tables. Do you have it? Because I can then borrow.
Thanks. Apologies for the chair. Okay.
So,
these subcategories, 1.2, 1.3, and 1.4, are examples out of the many actions or activities, list of activities. Out of the Section 21 list of activities, there are a number of different activities, and this is just an example. And for each activity, you have a minimum standard for particulate matter, for sulfur dioxide, for oxides of nitrogen, and in some cases you have other gases that we are controlling for a particular activity. And even more complicated is that we have two different standards. We have a standard which is called the existing plant standard, and we have a standard that is called the new plant standard. Now, let's take, for example, subcategory 1.2, liquid fuel combustion installations. There you can see that for particulate matter, there is a new plant standard of 50 milligrams per normal cubic meter, whereas your existing plant standard is higher than that. It's 75 milligrams per normal cubic meter. Now, to just clarify, and it's important that we have a common understanding of this, the existing plant standards are for 2015, and that is the 75. So if you go down to SO2, for example, again, your existing plant standard is 3,500, whereas your new plant standard is 500. Now that represents the transition from a time for SO2 being able to be emitted at a higher level than right now in 2015 than when we get to the new plant standard, which is 2020. So, and I know that this was a question, and it may be a question when we get to the actual performance applications that we're dealing with, but I just refer you back to these examples. Then, if we can, just moving on very quickly, and I'm not really going to touch in any
just
detail.
Just while you are there, when we come to the application,
yes.
What has been considered are these targets that we have yet now?
Yes.
That's what we consider.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well, and of course, for existing plants. But there's also the existing and new categories.
So, Chair, in some instances, a plant is already in compliance. Let's take SO2, for example. In some instances, plants are already in compliance with the existing plant standards. However, what they have to do is retrofit. They have to use the net, or they have to build in, and they have to invest and have an investment plan that enables them to build in the necessary technologies. In the case of SO2, it's in many cases, to gas desulfurization plants, which are expensive and which require not only an investment plan, but they also require a plan in which to do the actual retrofitting. So in some cases, plants have not needed a postponement for the existing plant standards, the 2015 standards, but they do need a postponement, for example, for the 2020 standard, because the 2020 standard is much stricter.
We are allowing a discussion here so that when we get to the actual, we have a better understanding. Honourable Member Sam.
Chair, I think I want to know what you want to know as well, and that is these new and existing plants. Now, from what date is a plant considered a new plant? Because there are companies that will be building perhaps in the last year or under current build and plan to build in the future. They will have to comply with new plant standards. But from what date? So if I started building a plant 2 years ago, what is that threshold? What is considered an existing plant and what is considered a new plant, so that you can get an idea of that? Thank you.
Before that, if there are any other questions or clarity on this aspect, okay, we have the numbers there, and these are the numbers that should be considered, or in fact, these are the standards of compliance. So this plant must comply to these standards. I think the question that also arises from what Stan is raising is the consideration by those that then fit with the applications among others. Honorable Witt?
I just take it since there's another people wearing, because they're still presenting, but I was reluctant to even ask now. I take it there is another table wearing, let's say SO2, wherein you're saying 2020 needed to be 500 and existing as on in 2015 needed to be 3,500, but that tells us of the overhead, the exceeding amount. Is there such a table wearing?
Let me clarify that so that we are at one. The performance of industry as we speak now, is that what you are speaking to? So that we,
yes, if they say we are not able to comply with the standard for 2015,
yes,
which is supposed to be 3.5, it means that they've gone beyond. And I'm saying in terms of their reporting, are they able to tell you that now are exceeding by so much, so that even as you agree or not agree, you know what you're dealing with? Am I okay?
We are together.
Chair, I think if I can ask Dr. Thule to come in on some of these issues. Thule?
There's only PhD in that.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, sir. Good morning, honorable members. I think I would just take two questions for now. The first one is to explain the difference between a new plant and an existing plant and the timeline. So the legislation does not provide for new plants to apply for performance as a starting point. A new plant must comply to the standards from the date of commissioning. The way they are defined, an existing plant is a plant that has been there. So the legislature has tied it to the environmental authorization, the EIA. If you had applied for EIA before 31 March 2010, to an existing plant, any application for EIA after 31 March 2010 is a new plant. The reason for that is the standard was published on the 31st of March 2010. So at that time, any plant that was in operation or had received authorization to construct and go ahead was an existing plant. Any time after that is a new plant. And the reason is that before you submit an environmental authorization application, you have finished the design of your plant. So you are already concluded. And perhaps, this is with the, if I have permission, I can explain. Therefore, that is why I'm a duty. in an existing plan. Because by the time the standards were published, Maduri had, EIA had gone, had been processed and granted, I think. So that is the difference. And just to first give a few seconds of context around why an existing plant would need a postponement. And I will use the example of Maduri. It has taken such a long time to construct, just to construct a plant itself. It will take a great amount of time to put in control technologies for evolution, because you need to construct the technology itself before you construct the pollution control technology to attach to it. So the understanding was that industries are different in scope and size. For example, some of them, like certain have different listed activities. They have boilers, they have incinerators, and so on and so on. If they were to construct pollution control technologies, they would definitely need different time frames for the different types of listed activities that exist there. So the provisions were there to say, as you construct, you provide your timeline on how long it will take you to reach compliance for those that are still in requiring the construction of pollution control technology.
But the value is that differentiating year is 2010. That's when the law came into being. Simple. And so if you came after 2010, you are new. If you were there, then there's no question of you applying, because we can't even grant you if you are not the license. So you get the license on the basis that you must comply. You must comply, no question about it. So if you were there before 2010, then you can speak to us and see how do you transit from your old to the new. Yeah.
By how much,
yes.
The second question was, if the standard is 500, the new plan standard, and the existing standard is 2500, and you say you have started the postponement, by how much? I think that is different per unit of the plan that we have granted, considered and granted postponement, but it's specific in the division. So, for example, you will have clearly for machine, but you have been granted a postponement is 2,600 milligrams. And in most cases, it's a reduction from the 2015 standard, but it's just that it's not a complaint to the 2020 standard. So the 2,600 and so on are higher than the 500 milligram standard, but they are lower than the 2015 standard. Thank you.
Yes, so much.
Yes, as a follow-up, I just want to check, what about the CIS? Is it a new plan? Because you say Mizuti is an existing plan, I understand that, but what about the CIS? That's the first one. The second one is that you did what you tell Dr. Mizuti, you went to the oversight to Sato. During the present, they were also highlighting the listed activities. They say they are doing this as a new what. I'm listening, Doctor.
That is for me. When I just continue asking your question, for you to ask whether it is good, just ask your question and get an answer. If you don't get an answer, we'll extract the answer.
And the representative of SACO, as we move from plant to plant, they were showing us to say, here we are doing this is a new structure, this is one. On those, I just want to be clarified on the listed activities that they mentioned. Under what category does that fall? Is it under new, or what is it? Where do we fall? Where do we categorize it? So that we must be able to know, it is also part of the exemption that are applying. So that we are at least we have concrete vision of what is happening, because it would seem it would refer us to the buildings, the pipes and all this, those of us who did the oversight of the telecom. Just clarity 16% of
that. Okay.
No, thanks, my apologies if I'm going to repeat, but I think I didn't understand the response brought from Doctor. I think the question that has been asked by Honourable Member Doctor, that the existing 3.5 granted, but if it happens that you exceed from 3.5 from the existing, what then becomes our view? What is that is actually acceptable if you have actually exceeded? I think it's the point that I just wanted to really get clarity from the existing. Let me see that goes 3,600 instead of 3,500. The amount of that, the exceeding.
Let me just come to the rescue of the doctors. But there are two applications that's about them. One application is for compliance with the 2015 standards as set by ARPA. The second one is compliance with 2020. Now, the doctor is saying, indeed, some applications might not necessarily be requesting postponement for compliance with the 2015 standard. They are asking for postponement of compliance with the 2020 standard, where in fact they are not, at the moment as they apply, they are complying with the 2015 standard, but they might not be able to meet the 2020. But maybe the doctor will put it in a doctor's language.
You see, sir, in as much as we are an institution that cannot work on the basis of suspicions, but if we suspect that the industry is reluctant to comply, not moving as it's supposed to, and they apply for postponement simply because they don't necessarily want to get there, and actually they want to even look for loopholes and so on. Because I want to be satisfied that as they apply, it's truly that indeed objectives they are not able to meet their standards. And not just on the basis that they want to go for profit, and as they pollute highly, not complying, and you grant, and basically allowing them space to do more harm, and by then they close the plant and leave or whatever. I don't want to work on the basis. I want to work on the basis of the responses that the department will have objectively found. But within that, we want to be satisfied that the instruments being used and whatever may be behind that is at all objective. I understand the two, the difference 2015, 2020, and that they want postponement. But the direct question is, all of them have they reduced? Or there are those that might not have even reduced, but they come forward and say, we request postponement. And you grant, because that you think that the conditions out there are such that they can't comply. But it's simply because they're not putting much effort to that.
I'm wondering whether I could be allowed just to conclude the presentation, because some of these issues are actually in the presentation.
Just hold it there. Baba Human, Onomi, and you can continue.
Thanks very much, Chair. Okay, I will ask this question because I see now you have opened the debate. I wanted to wait until the presentation is finished. There are some of these industries which the plants which are towards the end of their lifespan. And in my own understanding, if we grant them the extension, maybe by 2022, they close the plants will be closed. Do you really think that those industries will comply with the minimum emission standards by 2020? Because I don't think they will invest much, whereas they know in 2 years to come, they must close down the factory. So that's my concern, Mr. Chair. But I'll wait until the presentation is over to give more, to answer your question.
Banami?
Yes, Chair. I think he's far ahead of the 13. Now, we know the game people play with compliance. and non-compliance. At the end of the day, there has to be sanctions and not penalties. What kind of sanctions or penalties will be used?
I think the department is correct. If the questions are not answered, we'll then come back to them. But can we allow them to take us through the presentation? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. And I think then I will try and address the questions, and if we've not managed to address them, then we'll take another attempt. So, Chair, I think there is a desire to move rapidly through the contextual information. So I'm not going to go in any further detail on the various different instruments. It's in the presentation. But let's rather then move quickly, directly, to slide on page 13, which is more detail on section 21. So the various instruments that form part of the toolkit of the Air Quality Management Act are listed in the previous slides, but I'm referring you now to page 13 of the slide presentation, which is more detail on section 21. And that's the slide that is on the screen. So we've said that it provides for the Minister or NEC to publish a list of activities. And if we move then on to the next one, we've already dealt with the compliance timeframes, new plant, existing plant, both for the 2015 and the 2020. Then we go into some detail as to what the regulation actually says. And I think this is important, Chair, because we are using a legal process here. So we are ensuring, our job is to ensure that this legal process is followed consistently and applied comprehensively. So hence I would like to just go very briefly through it, and I also refer you to in more detail on page 5 of the memo, because that goes into a little bit more detail. That's on the narrative on page 5, goes into a little bit more detail. So Regulation 12 of the Section 21 notice, and this is the notice published by the Minister to give effect to Section 21 of the National Air Quality Act. The application for postponement must include the following, and this is important because it informs the basis of the decision. So all facilities had to submit an air pollution impact assessment, which was compiled in accordance with regulations. And again, this is important because there's a set of regulations that have issued that prescribe the format, what must go into the atmospheric impact report. And the reason this is important is because we have to be able to compare apples with apples to the extent that is possible. We must have a sufficiently robust and sufficiently comprehensive report in order to inform the decision on whether a postponement can be granted or not. Whether or not it's for the existing, for the new plant, whatever it is, it has to be informed. It must also have a detailed justification and reasons for the application. And there must be a concluded public participation process that is undertaken as specified in the NEMA Environmental Impact Assessment Regulation. So there's the link back to the National Environmental Management Act and its EIA regulations. And honourable members would have seen in the press over the period of time public adverts by these various facilities that were requesting postponement calling for a public participation meeting. There were a number of such adverts in the press. I think also to a very critical point in this discussion in terms of the legal provision is paragraph 13 of the Section 21 notice, is that the National Air Quality Officer, in concurrence, and this is with the concurrence of the licensing authority, may grant a postponement. Now, this is important, honourable members and honourable chair, because remember that the air quality, it's a complex area from a constitutional perspective. We have local authorities that are licensing authorities, we have provincial authorities which are licensing authorities, and we have the national authority which is now a competent authority in terms of the amendment, the NEMLA, the Amendment Act. So this, the decision in terms of a postponement application has to be made with the concurrence of the licensing authority, and this means that for every single application, the department sat with the relevant licensing authority to discuss the merits of the case. And this is why we could not take a blanket approach. We had to go step by step. We had to go look at the merits of every case. We had to have a very detailed discussion with each of the licensing authorities. I also want to just mention that on page 5, you will see Regulation 14 of the Section 21 notice. We did not include that as an additional slide, but it goes to the point that some of the honourable members are talking about. And this stipulates that the National Air Quality Officer, again, with the concurrence of the licensing authority, may, from time to time, review any postponement granted. Should ambient air quality conditions in the affected area of the plant not conform to ambient air quality standards? And this is the critical issue. In the case that a particular area reaches dangerous level, what do we do? How do we review the situation? And on good grounds, the National Air Quality may withdraw in postponement following representation from the affected plant and representation from the affected community. Chair, let me proceed with this. So here we have what I've already mentioned, the legal provisions, compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, completed atmospheric impact report, demonstration that the industry's air emissions are and will not cause adverse impact on the surrounding environment. Now, this requires an assessment of a time frame over if we are granting postponement, for example, from the 2015 to 2020 or from 2020 to 2025, this assessment or this demonstration that industry's air emissions are and will not cause adverse impact means we have a timeline implication, and we have to look 5 years ahead and we have to look 10 years ahead. The next set of slides just is a very quick summary of the applications received, the 37 applications received. We are still awaiting documentation from two of these applications, for applicants. And the information is quite straightforward. Who is the applicant? Where is geographically, which province is it located in, and who is the licensing authority? And there you can see that in almost all cases, or in many cases, it's the district municipality that is the licensing authority, or it's the provincial, with Cape Town Metro there in the case of Eskom Acacia, etc. I won't go through all of it, but it gives you a very quick overview. The next critical issue is what was the general approach to making the determinations, reaching a decision, and this is in concurrence with the licensing authority. And Chair, here I just want to again refer honourable members to page 17 of the memorandum, and it's paragraph 5, considerations informing the decision. And at halfway through page 17, you'll see there is general approach undertaken. And this is the general approach that was informing the decisions in each case. So I don't have a slide on this, but I'm going to just go through it very quickly. For particulate matters, postponements were only granted for the period between 2015 and 2020, and not beyond. So it was only for postponements were only for the period 2015 to 2020, existing plant standards to 2015. And the reason for this is that the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for both particulate matter of the size 10 and 2.5 have become stricter from the 1st of January 2015. So we actually are in the situation of having to do further atmospheric impact assessment for anything beyond the period. Because if it's stricter, remember that we're dealing now both with the ambient air quality standards within the particular area that we're talking about, a priority area, for example, and those are the standards that have become stricter for particulate matter beyond 2015. So that is where we need to do that further work. We restricted ourselves. In terms of sulfur dioxide, Allocations were made for a number of facilities. For the period 2015, postponements in general were not necessary, as the initial reports indicated that most facilities are operating in compliance with the 2015 standards. And I think this is also an indication that refers to the Honourable Member's question about the what is informing the decision, because of we were checking compliance with legislative requirements, the atmospheric impact report, the regulations for atmospheric dispersion modeling, public participation, etc. We were also looking at the emission reports. Remember, these industries, in terms of their atmospheric emission license, are required to submit emission reports. And so these emission reports are a very, very key basis of data and basis of information to inform the decision-making process. However, for most plants, and this is still on top of the downside, for most plants, postponements were granted from 2020 to enable facilities to invest towards future compliance where possible, and also because some plants are due to be decommissioned. And this is this decommissioning question. This is a balancing. It's a balancing. This is an absolute archetypal example of how do you balance the economic, the social, and the environmental issues here. Because the point was made by the Honourable Member, in the case where a plant is due to be decommissioned in 2025, for example, there is an economic assessment that has to be taken. Of course, it has also requires the social assessment on the other side, but do you invest, do you spend the considerable investment for retrofitting with flue gas desulfurization technology, for example, when a plant is likely to be decommissioned in 2025, which is why it was critical that we had in our possession information about the dates when plants were likely to be decommissioned. So that was information that also informed this decision-making process. And then finally, Chair, that last paragraph, the oxide of nitrogen, the NOxes. A number of applicants requested postponements regarding compliance with oxides of nitrogen. This required careful analysis, and postponements where feasible were granted, although in some specific cases it was found that most facilities already are in compliance with the 2020 standards. So in general, there was compliance with the 2020 standards, but there were in some cases, and we can see on the tables where there were cases in which there was a postponement granted for either the 2015 or the 2020 or not. And I think just to say that NOxes are not, although they're not directly a problem polluting for the country, they do require monitoring, because in a situation where there's a mix of a toxic mix, and this is where I need the doctor to come in and help me with the kinds of mixture of these chemical compounds. NOx is a precursor to ozone, and we need to manage this. It's one of those cases where, for example, you get the China smog, the terrible China smog, where you get a very bad combination of weather conditions plus burning, for example, plus emissions, and you end up with a toxic concoction. So then, just to say that the tables then provide an overview of the postponement decisions made by the department, and Honourable Chair, you ask us to try and keep it simple so that it was easy to look with a quick glance at what is the status. So we do not have the exact numbers, because the truth is that the exact numbers are complicated, because dealing with a huge range of different activities, you're dealing with different types of standards, so hence we thought that this was a better way of presenting it. Red indicates cases where the applications for postponements were declined, green indicates cases where applications for postponement were granted, and the blue indicates cases where the applicant in fact did not apply for postponement. So here in the end slide, you can see in terms of each of the facilities, you've got the three different columns. You've got for particulate matter in the first column, both for 2015 and 2020. You've got sulfur dioxide in 2015 and 2020, and you've got NOx 2015 and 2020. And then at a glance, you can see where it was granted, where it was not granted, or where there was not a postponement. similarly for PDC. This was specifically for particulate matter, and then there's in the PDC case, there are other pollutants that they were not applying for. And again, Anglo-American, this was their primary issue, was for SO2, for Shell. Total organic volatile compounds. There's another doctor in the house, honorable chair. I'm very lucky to be supported by very well qualified people, and you can tell how it's important that we have a very qualified team in the department to deal with this issue. There you can see again for particulate matter or engine and for the total volatile organic compounds, etc. Sasol, I'm not going to go through in any detail. I think this is where if there are any specific questions, you can see for Sasol it becomes even more complicated, where there's a whole set of other chemicals that need pollutants that need postponements for. And I think this is probably where Thule and her team would be best placed to come in with any further detail. I think just finally, Chair, in terms of general approach, we've touched very briefly on the fact that the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for particulate matter have become stricter, and so this requires further analysis and therefore no postponements beyond 2020. And I think here this is the issue that was also raised earlier, that applications were analyzed by a specialized team as well as with the Atmospheric Emission Licensing Authority, so it brought to bear the different skill sets and the different understandings of a particular challenge. And it includes studying these emission monitoring reports, as we said, which expertise submits to the licensing authorities. And in many cases it reveals that facilities were actually compliant. Now this is a case where, this is a very human case where, or very almost an expected situation in which people want to be extremely safe, so they were in compliance in cases. Some cases facilities were already in compliance with a particular standard, but they submitted postponement applications to give themselves additional space. Now, in those instances, we could not grant those postponement applications because they were already showing to be in compliance. And they were actually wanting to get emission caps, the best possible situation, which is not the approach of the National Air Quality Act. That was the approach, indeed, for the Atmospheric Pollution Prevention Act, but not in the case of the UPA. Honourable Chair, that's the presentation. And I think perhaps there may be some questions that are still hanging, and that we can assist with. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stana, Kohane, Ketana, Baba Mandulek, Makubel. I nearly married you to Mandulek. Stana?
Niabulela Tishalo. I just wanted to find out, this table is very helpful. However, in terms of the granted applications, it would have been interesting to see what the emission standard applied was. So, for example, in each of these green blocks, if the new emission standard had been entered there, to see how it differentiates from 2015 and 2020. So, for example, if the emission standard for Camden in Eskom was going to be 500 for the 2020 SOC, and they were granted their application and the standard was applied, were going to be 600, for example, then that would have been very interesting, because I've seen your recommendations on page 27 of the memo. It says that we need to note the process and decisions made, but we cannot note all of your decisions unless you have that information. So I just wanted to get clarity about how you took the decision to grant applications within areas that had already been identified as priority areas. So we've got these three hotspots where people's lives and health we know is at risk, and I understand that you try to balance economic development versus people versus the environment, but in already identified hotspots, how did you make those decisions? then in your presentation, in the memo, under the general decisions, I think it was okay, under the section table. General approach. Yes, mentioned, for example, that on particulate matter, you will not be granting any postponement post 2020. When you have made policy decisions like that now, do you foresee that you will maybe amend those decisions closer to the time, or is that your stuck and fast decision? And then I just wanted to find out, when did you, I know that engagement with stakeholders regarding the new emission standards has been long in the pipeline, but when did you actually inform industry players these are the new emission standards? I'll leave it there for now and exercise self-monitoring. Thank you, Chair.
Good. Both of them.
He was about to finish all the questions that I wanted to ask.
I should come from your podcast.
Thanks very much, Chair. I think let's put some human aspects on the list of things now. I would like to know, of all these industries that have applied for extension, did they provide the department with the health impact on the communities around the industry? And they have given the place to mitigate the impact that will be, the impact that will have on the communities around these industries. I will stop it for now.
Was next, Mayor Gega.
Mine is a Molanyano question.
It's Molanyano.
What happens to a company that has not applied for postponement, but yet do not comply?
Good. Yes, in fact, maybe just highlight those penalties. They are not highlighted. We can just highlight them. What next, Mbabe?
Chair, just two issues. The first relates to having granted the postponement, then you may need to withdraw on particular grounds. And I've seen those grounds on page 5, and in the main, those reasonable grounds or good grounds for postponement are based on two things. The first being representation from the affected plant or let's say by the industry. In terms of that relevant plant. But the second is about the representation from the affected community. My take is that where we are now, we highly rely on the honest reporting by the industry. If they don't become honest, it becomes very difficult to tell otherwise. And we know that the affected communities, mostly poor people staying in that vicinity, do not have the capacity to scientifically monitor anything. So largely we are granting or we have given rights to people who may not be in any way better qualified unless they just tell about their health hazards or whatever other indications, but they may not scientifically say we're suffering from this particular thing. So you don't expect much representation from them, and I'm not saying they can't argue or say anything. I'm just saying the withdrawal of this postponement seems to be very slim if you rely on the industry to report and say, give you a right to even withdraw. So they are likely not to report better if they know the consequences. So I'm just saying, if we have got licensing authorities or government whose monitoring stations may not be functional, some of them are dysfunctional, and you then rely largely on the private sector,
to do that, that particular industry, maybe a very serious issue, and some problematizing that, just to show that we still have got a long way to go to be able to can go to the second part, having granted postponement. That's the one point. The second is that there's call or requirement for public participation as and when some of these things are done. But there has been an issue raised by NGOs that some of these big companies, when they deal with stakeholder relations and so on, they usually focus on high-level kind of engagement. And the people who are in the neighborhood or in that vicinity, some of these NGOs, are not even considered in some of those engagements. So it's an area for concern which I felt it was more important to know that if you say you are a salamitar or whoever, but your kind of engagement with the public or stakeholders is at a very high level, to the extent that you are national or international, but there are people there in the valley you don't take on board, it's going to be very problematic. And that's saying we need to find a way of, as government, enforcing that when we talk of public participation, it takes on board even the very people affected, so that they feel that their input and so on and so on are considered, they do participate in what is likely to be the outcome, and not just hear of the outcome by other people who don't even stay there, or if this solution does not even affect them. Thanks.
Bokonomi, Murabela, Pungane, and Nabila.
Here's a small one.
Then the chair.
Yeah. Here's a small one. It says several has several synonyms, but it leads to the conclusion that the solution to keep waste by incineration was not the best because it creates other issues for the environment. What other methods are in place or replace the incineration?
No, mine is just an interest to understand because I can see that we are dealing with issues at a higher level. I would imagine a person, an ordinary person in Sasolburg, if you have ever been the chairperson, some there. Air pollutants, as you enter the air, you can feel that you can't keep up with the air pollutants and all of that. But we find that in terms of the standards, we see that no, it's something that is actually acceptable. But we find that in the long run, the very same people of the community are affected by what it has been said that it is actually acceptable in terms of the standard. I mean, they're being affected by the very same air pollutants. I'm just interested, how do we deal with what is the cause for people that might find themselves in such issues? Because a guarantee was given by people that they have full confidence in government to say that no, there's no harm, you can stay here, there's nothing. But even yourself, as you go through the area, you can feel that through this it might be enough also if you are not there. Because people end up getting used to the situation but and get affected at the end of the day. Thanks.
Puman.
Thanks very much, Harry. It's not a question, but it's just one to get clarity. On one of the slides, where it was elevated in subcategory 1.2, where it were according to the slide liquid fuel combustion, if you are allowed to emit on a particular matter 50 as a new industry or a new company existing up to 75, wouldn't it be the companies like this, an existing company which is allowed to emit up to 50, wouldn't they come back and say, as a new company, will not be allowed to emit up to, but not exceed 75. Will the dependent on the company come to you and say, currently I'm emitting 750, or I'm allowed to emit 50. will you can be to make up and but not exceed 75 accidents? Will you give these companies to do or to emit or to have accidents but not more than 75? That would be my issue.
Pardon?
The disability of asking questions last year, you are covered in most instances. But just inform just a brief comment here. I think there's no doubt that the AQA is a progressive act in advancing Section 24 of the Constitution to ensure that the quality ambient air for the sake of securing the environment and for the people. So we're deeply encouraged on page 17 where the department recommits itself to ensure that it safeguards the environment. On page 7, the department is making a reflection that at least 1,000 facilities or companies have licenses. But I would like the department, in terms of the inventory, if it is possible, to indicate to us how many are supposed to have and how many are not having. Just a reflection on that. On page, there's an indication that in Cape Town there was no cooperation as stated previously. I might have missed the previous reason stated. Can the department just reiterate to us why, in particular, in terms of AEL, there was no cooperation in Cape Town? Who can be given? It's on page, let me see. It's on page 23, item C, page 23, general approach and observation. Yes. Those are the questions. Thank you. Thank you. And don't forget about Kusile, which you asked, so that you have to us. You must take doctor in your response. Thanks.
I think let's allow that if we'll take a second one. I know this is quite a matter that, as Cordelia has indicated, it's a matter that speaks to the public health of our people. But equally, that's why the delicate balance is needed, equally, is also a matter that speaks to job creation, economic activities, and the eradication of poverty through these units that are expected to be to pollute less. So I think at the end of the day we should find comfort that one, in my view, there is recourse. If in the view of the government air quality has now gone for the worse after the granting, we have a concern. I think that's something that we should appreciate, that our law makes that possible. But more importantly, as per the report, our laws would like to first know what is the level of emissions as we speak. So that as you grant, you are fully cognizant of the level of emissions, but what broadly does that level of emissions contribute to the broader community in the area? So all these matters are taken into cognizance. One issue that I agree with colleague on, if the reviewer is on the two grounds and there is no obligation on government, then there is a problem. Because you can't expect those companies to report themselves, but you see what we are causing a mess now in the community. The community might not have the capacity. Therefore, who is the relative of the people? Government. So maybe there's one little point that is missing there. What is the effect of the monitoring stations on this matter of reviewers? And the work of Dr. Turi and her team, because as we have granted, I think the onus would basically lie on us more as government, as people who have granted the postponement to even be more vigilant that there is nothing, because in this people can say, yes, we are in this mess now because of you. So therefore the onus is on us, we are given the postponement to be absolutely certain that in those areas we don't have the air quality being adversely impacted upon during the period of postponement. Of course, the question asked by Madam Stena, I was also going to ask it, does it make any sense for us to those areas that are already have serious difficulties, among them, COSA has also spoken to those, sorry, remember, Robert, you have got hot spot already. I know what the law says. The law says any of the companies can apply. That's what the law says. But already we have got people who are impacted upon negatively. That's why we have called that area a hotspot. Because the air quality there is really probably harmful, if not attended to. In the long run, it will be harmful to the well-being of people, or is already harmful. How do we... Now, we are not questioning, by the way, what that we have done. We are not. By the way, the Constitution and also the law gives you the jurisdiction to make decisions that you've made. But we are asking as representatives of those people there, how do we postpone in an area that is already under strain on this matter? We will come back if there are some questions, but can we allow you to respond so that we don't lose the essence of the question?
I'm requesting that we ask Tuli, then Judy, and then I'll come in. But we start also with earlier questions before the conclusion of the presentation. Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
I've recorded the previous questions. I'll start with Kusile, because that was the first one in the previous round. Kusile is an existing plant according to the definition of the legislation, and they have not applied for postponement. So it's a decision that you didn't apply for postponement because they are for compliance. The other question was around Sasol during the oversight visit that the portfolio conducted. Sasol as a whole is an existing plant. Although the units within the facility may have been constructed at different times, but according to the definition, Sasol is an existing plant. And if they were to apply now for a new AIA for a new unit, then that would fall under new plant standards. But what the portfolio saw at that time, all existing plant units. In terms of the question around what was the acceptable exceedance in granting these postponements, we use emission reports. We look together with the licensing authorities. We look at current performance just to make sure that we are not granting anything above what the plant is able to operate at a level. And I think we can talk about it. We can give the actual numbers. Actually, because it was included in the previous meeting that the portfolio committee didn't like. But they can bring it.
Then you extracted that.
The committee is too technical, so I narrowed it down to a yes and no. But still, there is available information it can be shared. As to the issue around suspicion, and I think the legislation allows us, when we reasonably believe that with the non-compliance, to constitute a compliance monitoring exercise. If I can give an example, during the analysis of the application, we had, for the Secunda, that is scrutiny around what the city had submitted to the National Evaluation Office and what they were reporting to the licensing authority. So I reasonably believed that the matter needed to be checked, and so I communicated to the chief copier, and they did the compliance monitoring exercise and reported it to come. So reasonable belief...
Who's the chief copier? Is it the DJ?
The boy. It's funny for you, but the report is still coming. So I'm just giving the comfort that when you reasonably believe that there might be enough compliance, you can institute a compliance monitoring exercise and get to the bottom of it in terms of the legislation. So
that is there. But in when we are considering the application test, where we request it for compliance roadmap. If you say not able to comply with the current limits, what is your roadmap to coming into compliance with that limit over time? And so this will be monitored during the time. So for example, the facility has said by 2018 we have constructed the loan of them, and then by 2019 we do this. Our monitoring will be around that to say, is that by 2018 we have done this, but there is no and perhaps to just give comfort to the committee, we had a similar situation as that event with AMSA. There was, the electric appliances, they were supposed to have constructed back houses to extract some of the particulate matter at a certain time, and they didn't. And so they elected, to, because of compliance monitoring, to shut down those furnaces because they were not, according to the investment schedule that they had provided, they were not going to do, so they shut them down. So the compliance monitoring works hand in hand with us. There was another question around industries coming to end of life, whether they still need to, whether those industries would invest to come into compliance. I think what we did is look at current performance to make sure that such interests do not increase from where they are at the moment. But if we were to, I'm trying to refrain from making specific examples, but if you were to look at a fluid waste desalination plant that would cost around 20 billion to construct and would take another 5 or 8 years in itself to construct, and the plant is shutting down in 5 years, it is really not economically feasible for the country to expect those kinds of investments. And as a result, the personal decisions are linked to the time we face the plant we shut down. It must shut down because we have made projections around coming to compliance and funding for the standards. And where the plants are not scheduled for decommissioning, we have made the requirements to say, for Kendall example, it's not scheduled to be decommissioned, we therefore expect that they will come to compliance with the 500 by 2020. So they have time to invest and come to compliance with that. Also based on the amount of contribution that the plant produces in a priority area. In terms of the penalties that can be imposed, then the maximum is 10 million. Yes. So there are different penalties. The penalties are stipulated in the Act. And I think it's a good process that would perhaps be 1328. Okay, the next question was the one started with where do the portfolio request actual numbers, what are granted, which are that we can supply later. The other question was how do you grant postponements in priority areas? I think the first thing for me to mention here is the National Code of 2007 indicated that you should not consider applications in the priority areas. I think that we must be clear about. But we looking at the objectives of the Air Quality Act itself, the health impact, there's also sustainable development and ecologically sustainable development. So in essence, is to make that balance between the imperatives that exist. And we have done effort management plans in the climate area, which the slight sensitivity put up. And we understand the complex mixture of sources of pollution in the climate areas. So in this regard, our understanding is that industries are not a contributor, but are not the sole reason for the excesses. So as a result, it would be, I think, controversial to permit industries or even the sources that they are not responsible for. And we have also required a atmospheric impact report to understand the individual contribution of each of those plants in the ambient environment when we consider these applications. So. And in addition to that, for the plants that are in the priority areas, we've required for them to conduct offset projects to reduce the ambient pollution in the environment. So for example, when you look at the particulate matter in the high field, the biggest source, yes, that's contribute, for the industry contribute, but the biggest source is mining operations to that particulate matter. So it's clear that even if all ESCOM was shut down and there was no particulate matter coming from ESCOM, you would have exodus of particulate matter because the bigger source is not the industry. And perhaps when we talk about the effects of pollution on human health, I can loosely talk about what we have found when we did the gene studies. Industries make a big contribution to air pollution, but we should look at where they are. A tank, for example, would be 30 meters above the ground. So they emit, that's 25 milligrams of particulate matter, 30 meters above the ground. So it could create a high breath count, is what you call in scientific terms, of pollution in the air. Because there's a source, it's a continuous source, it comes into the atmosphere. However, if you compare that to me making a fire in my house, first of all, the pollution is far higher than that 75 milligrams. And it's right here in front of me, I inhale it as it is, in complete combustion from whatever fuel I'm using, and so on and so on. So we are trying to get into, as we explained, resolving the complex mixture of problems using the different provisions that are there in legislation. I think we have been criticized for having said domestic burning is the only problem. It's not the only problem. It's a multiple problem because you have it right there and then. No pollution abatement, nothing whatsoever. It just comes to you straight as it is, and it's very toxic, to be honest. There was a question around the decision not to grant performance for 2020, the policy decision, or we can revise it. It was a decision because the UN quality standards for 2015 are strict. They become stricter now in 2015 than they have been before. And so we want to monitor the compliance with those standards over time. And then we can be able to see whether we are moving towards the compliance or not. The legislation does not prohibit plants to apply a year before, which means they would then apply again in 2019 if they still felt they needed postponement. However, the impact report that they are supposed to apply as part of the application would then have taken into account the standards that exist at the time, instead of taking a previous standard that is more relaxed than the current one and applying for a future. We want to have the most current assessment in around 2019 when, if they come back to apply for postponement. So I think that clarifies that. The legislation was published on the 31st of March. The question around when did industry know about this standard? 31st of March 2010. The negotiation process happened in over 5 years, so it has been clear that this requirement is there. However, the reason the legislation still had provisions for application for postponement was the complexity of some of the industries was understood at that stage, that for some industries they would need more than 5 years due to the size and complexity of it to invest in the pollution control technologies. And so the idea was to give them that amount of time to invest to come into compliance, because the objective is not to shut them down. The objective is to manage air pollution and bring it to compliance. And perhaps in a different presentation one day we can show the number of industries that already comply. Because some of them, for example, the cement plants, one little activity is simpler to construct pollution control and comply with the standard, as opposed to a land that has a host of different activities. There's an incinerator, there's a boiler, there's, you know, it would be, and the tank also for the, it would be a bit more complex. So those provisions were to take care of some of those transitional requirements. There was another question around if applicants provided health impact from surrounding communities. Yes, the requirement is they must do a health impact assessment, and it takes into consideration the surrounding environment. It's been very clear what the surrounding environment means, and they must do modeling to show where their impact would go and how much of that impact goes to the community. So the impact reports have given those considerations. What happens to a company who has not applied for postponement and then does not comply with the emission standards? There are scorpions in the department to sting those offenders. The question around the need to withdraw the postponement decision and the fact that our people may not be fully capacitated to make those representations that the legislation is referring to. Perhaps I can just explain in head how the licensing authorities manage the facilities, and maybe they are the proper representatives of the people, because they are the ones who hold industries accountable to what their atmospheric emission licenses are saying they can emit, and how they should manage some of the city resources in their facilities. So, although industries are required to report quarterly, in some cases or otherwise, just like in the Asian, the authorities also check whether there's compliance or not. In fact, we've done different training on step monitoring so that they can actually go and check the steps whether they are emitting what they are committed to emit or not. But there is also, the consequences are also attached to conditions with timeline. For example, one of the conditions is that by the end of June 2015, SACCOL will provide us with a comprehensive offset plan. If that doesn't happen, obviously then I'm compliant to the decision that has been issued. That would also be a ground for withdrawal in that case. The monitoring stations around the facility there, just to clarify that the monitoring team would monitor ambient air. So the whole complex mixture of pollution that is in the atmosphere is monitored by the monitoring station. It may be owned by the municipality, it may be owned by ESCOM, it may be owned by National Idea, for example, but it does not measure only what comes from one source, it measures the complex mixture of pollution. Just yes, to show you, if you analyze further and look at the wind resources, you can get some understanding of which side the wind was coming from, and then you can look at the sources around that side where the wind came from during that particular time. But you cannot conclusively use ambient air quality data to pinpoint and then compliance of an air source. It has been very complicated and difficult to get to those conclusions, unless there was a field or something that you can directly measure around a specific period of time. Titi, may I leave the shortcomings of the public participation process to you to take on that? And what other methods are there to treat waste other than incineration? I believe there are many methods to treat it, but depending on the type of waste, incineration is also a viable option because you can control how much of that pollution goes into the atmosphere. But I'm not going to spend much time on that. But in the legislation, even for normal dealers, where they then waste as well, waste calorific waste, a different requirement. So now that you are also burning waste in your body, you must now comply and ensure that your dioxin insurance are not above this and so on and so on. So just to make sure that you still protect the people in terms of what comes out of this day. Chronic effects of air pollution. I wish there was a fund like the Earth Fund to take care of those of our time. But we do not have a fund like that. We are monitoring and reporting compliance, and we are clear in terms of what impact would be as a result of pollution. We've actually now done a health study we are going to complete in July, because once we understand the health profile of the people in the various areas, if we get funds, we can roll out a similar study in the high priority area. We have that intention. And the intention is to update this study over time, at least 5-year period, to look at whether the vulnerability to the groups has improved, and we expect it should improve because we are implementing the quality management plans and trying to manage the sources of air pollution. But this is what we can report. I think it's a very complex mixture between the genetic compositions and exposure and so on around air pollution. But we understand that air pollution has chronic effects on human health. That is why we are controlling it so strongly. Questions around what if you are in a new plant and you now want to say you are an emitter 50, but I want to be able to emit until 75. First of all, there's no provision for new plants to apply for correspondence. That's very clear in legislation. If you're a new plant, as you come into operation, you must comply with new plant standards. Secondly, it was covered in today's presentation, there is no provision for emission caps in the Equality Act. You have a limit, you comply with that limit, or you face the rest of the scope. So there's no discussion there around whether we would like some flexibility or not. The flexibility you have is between 0 and 50. Then you can be flexible around whether you want 45 or 5. That's basically okay. Which means you are not in operation. But that is there. At the moment, we have around 1,000 atmospheric emission license facilities in the country. And we have developed an inventory system for reporting. Right now, 878 of those health registered. We are still registering facilities. So I think that gives the context that we have 37 applications, but we have over 1,000, which means the bulk of our industry indicates.
Once you register, doctor, we are doing 800 and something as registered. What is registering in simple Zulu or English?
Okay.
Can I choose Zulu?
We have developed an inventory system for reporting. If you want to understand what is the emissions profile in the country, where does one know how much Pacific matter comes from this, you know, this area. So registering means that those licensed activities have registered into the system. They are ready to report how much of the pollution they are putting into the atmosphere. This is an additional requirement from the reporting for compliance that exists in the atmospheric emission license. The reporting that you must do for compliance purposes, that's this reporting to the inventories for us as government to have a clear understanding of each of the areas, how much each pollutant is coming out in that area. So the registering is that, registering into the system to report manually.
That is.
Yes.
That is.
Yes. And then there was a question around 523 items, see why there was no cooperation from with your paper. The legislation is clear that the National Air Quality Council will restore those decisions with the concurrence of the Atmospheric Emission Licensing Authority. As a result, we will hold meetings with the licensing authorities. They bring to the table the information that they have within NMAC. But the City of Cape Town did not attend those meetings. And because we needed to look at current performance, we then obtained those emission reports directly from the facilities. I think that's what that is referring to.
I just want to show that we are not seen to be targeted. Well, they are the only licensing authorities that did not present themselves as their law expects. Were they the only ones or were there others?
There was also Buffalo City that did not avail themselves for the meeting.
I think this was the question from the chair raising up. What is the effect of the monitoring obligations on the granting of postponement? I think I would like to take an overall explanation on this one and say what we are measuring in the atmosphere right now in our monitoring stations is what the state of air is. These postponements do not constitute an addition. There is nowhere in the postponements where we have granted more than current plant performance to measure that. The list that we have is to maintain the current ambient quality and look at other ways of getting industries to help us reduce the ambient air pollution burden that we are measuring in the atmosphere. So the monitoring, I think the safe of air already includes, what we have here. But we also have improvements that are being forced through the performance process. So, for example, with the limit is 2,500 and we've granted 2,600. What happened that improvement to say, although you cannot comply with the 500, don't accept the 2,500, come down to 2,600 for this period of time. This is how I can explain that. And also, the priority areas still cover the fact that we have a broad understanding of what the pollution sources are. Thank you.
Can I just add, quickly, I think the schedule that was circulated, you have this table, did you circulate? This table and our members give information about the facilities that currently are reporting to SACI, which is the air quality information. So these monitoring stations, I think the DDG earlier on was saying that as of November last year, they were not, most of them were not even operational in terms of what is expected. And through the MINMEC discussion and MECs being brought on board and the HODs, the situation has improved.
So we hope that we will continue to then make sure that at least government monitoring stations are compliant, whether they are provincial or national or even a local government. Secondly, so in essence, we think that the monitoring and compliance situation is not perfect, but we will continue to improve on it, and the efforts are then part of the plan to continue to improve in that regard. Secondly, I thought that I should also mention that the minister already is publishing, I think there is a notice, they are not yet published, a notice on the mandatory annual reporting by these stations, monitoring stations. So again, this is about ambient air quality, it's not about those individual facilities. And this is to report to the National Environmental Air Quality System. Okay, so that those regulations are going to be published, if not in a week's time or 2 weeks time, but the minister is already, they have been processed to the minister after the intergovernmental process with provinces. Thirdly, I think the other question around the recourse, beyond just the enforcement, compliance and enforcement provisions are in NIMA. There is a whole process that you follow when a facility is non-compliant or even other organs of state are not compliant. We issue pre-compliance notice and follow through all of those processes in terms of the National Environmental Management Act. But the second aspect I think I understood of that question is around what would be in place to compensate members or individuals or families. I think that in essence I'm hearing that as a suggestion that requires the setting up of a national pollution fund so that companies could contribute to that fund, especially those that are exceeding. But we don't have that in law. So I think as a legislator, I would think that that's something that maybe the department can look at and compare what is in place in other countries. In the ocean environment, there is a pollution fund, an international pollution fund, but maybe we could look at something like that internally in terms of the future. So this is an aspect that we would have to research. At this point in time, we are not... we don't have any ability in law to put that in place. And then lastly, the matter about communities and the empowerment of people to make representations, again, I think we still have really that line for NGOs and other civil society groupings to help make communities understand. As a department, we do hold various engagements from time to time, but even that I would think is far from being sufficient in terms of making sure that people understand what their rights are and how they can exercise their participation in those processes, even in respect of environmental impact assessment. Remember, these facilities get authorized through a legally outlined process. The whole EIA process requires public participation process, and the stakeholders they outlined as affected and interested parties, affected being the communities directly, and therefore studies get undertaken at that point of the EIA before it is the authorization is issued, and even before a waste license is issued, or even before the air quality emission license is issued. So we have that in law, and I think it, in terms of taxation, probably we better than if we did not even have those provisions. But again, we still continue to have to engage and improve. And I guess even the role of this House is to make sure that when there are those debates, I guess last year the Portfolio Committee went to some of the communities, maybe we still have to do more of that just to be able to allow representation by the communities in respect of
these matters, but I don't think we can say it is sufficient, and we can look at other mechanisms of continuous empowerment of communities. Thank you very much.
Stana Pungane, then the deputy, the last one. It's now 10 to 12. At 12 we must start with the other matter that we have put on our order.
Thank you, Chair. Just very quickly, when and where will all the individual MES decisions be made available to the public? And with regards to the compliance roadmaps, are you sure? I mean, because of course you looked at each of the applicants' roadmaps. Are you sure that A, they are realistic, and B, that they are strict enough to ensure that they don't come a year before the next time and say, look, we're going to need another postponement? And then with regards to the offsets, who is going to determine those offsets? Because if I come to you and say, right, my offset plan is to, you know, provide electrical stoves to the community and I'm going to provide 2,000, are you going to then say, is that a justifiable offset, or are you going to then say, no, that's not good enough, you need to do more?
Thank you, thank you. Can we allow the other questions to stand, and you can even send them for written reply from the department? Well, Puma, unless he gave you his question.
That's one. Right. I just wanted to find out, dust emissions from mining is one of the biggest contributors to particulate matter, like you mentioned. Are you seeing any reduction in these emissions, or what is your department's plan to deal with mining? Because no mining companies have applied for any applications for postponement. So how do you then enforce the air quality emission standards on industries like mining? Thank you.
One issue lingering in my mind that gives me some confusion, and I just want that clarified a little bit. When we measure ambient air quality, we're saying we're measuring the state of the air in that area as a whole. That will include all of that, from various sources that I met, that were not able to link the contribution from particular source necessarily. But we then go to company and then say, you would want you to reduce like this. But we say, perhaps we are able to measure the company contribution, but we are not able to link that one. It's in the air. Just as a difficulty, why we say the entire area is highly polluted, and this company is there, but we say we can't approach contributions by sources. Perhaps because there will be those from individual households and so on. I get that. But I will still contend that individual or households collectively can't exceed that of the industry, even if you inhale that directly and so on. So I think industry still is a major polluter, and that understanding should remain, because then once we start like we want to equate that, I think we'll have a problem. But yes, it may be that in your own house you burn coal and so on, and so forth, particular challenges there. But in that, it's what the clarity that I need to share is, if we say the contribution from this particular source to this plant and to the air, we can't tell, but we want to pin them down to particular levels, how do we get that? So I know that we talk particulate matter, which does not have any chemical symbol. We talk the total volatile organic compound, that does not have any chemical symbol, but we are able to differentiate them once in the air. But we are not able to say they come from this source. And but we want to somewhat paralyze this company contribute to that area. That's the way the confusion is, Chair. And that's if you don't get that, I may go on. But I think I've made my point to say I'm confused a little bit as to how do we link or want to penalize companies when we can't tell what they've contributed in the air, because it's just everybody's contributions there.
Did you say, now I'm not having that, I'm not putting it to you. Did you say the contributions from household combustions are more toxic than contributions from industry? So that we are clear and explain it. Because you said, I will take it that you say that the contributions from industry are up there, and the contributions from households are at the household level, inside the household. If it is not properly explained, it might give right to confusion. So maybe it needs some explanation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let us start with that. No. I am not saying household contribution is more toxic than industrial contribution. I am making the point that industrial contribution, at least the industries are nature of the pollution, that is why we regulate them squarely. I am saying the pollution that comes out from an industry has time to mix in the atmosphere before it gets to a person, as opposed to the one that comes out right here and now and you inhale directly. And I hope I'm clear there. I'm not saying one is more toxic than the other. And I may use an example of Imbaula fish. You will recall that there were times that people would die from the use of Imbaula fires. And that would be precisely because the carbon monoxide is right here.
Undiluted.
Aircom emits carbon monoxide, like every combustion process would emit that. But by the time it gets to a person walking down the street, it's at a lesser level than the one that you inhale directly. I hope I'm making that this. I'm not in any way reducing the impact of that industry has on air pollution significant its nature. I'm just saying you can dilute it from what you inhale, I say, as opposed to what will take maybe 30 minutes to get to where you are. And I think we've had this difficulty with a lot of industries who are saying, why do you give us new emission standards? Why don't you manage ambient air pollution? We need to have industrial pollution control. That is, all over the world, industries are controlled as individual sources of pollution. And in the forest areas, we are clear that there are far more sources. We are not saying any one of those sources is less significant. We are saying every significant source must be managed so that we measure an overall reduction in pollution. You can use, just to other Honourable Mahuela's question, you can use ambient air quality data to define a signature to understand the source of pollution. For example, there are pollution signatures. If it's an industrial source, it's a continuous source. So any time of the day, the level will stay where it is because it's a continuous source. But for domestic burning, for example, the signature is that there will be a peak in the morning and a peak in the afternoon because it's that kind of source. It is similar to vehicle emissions. So you can use that to say the contributor here is this. What I'm saying is in most cases, unless you have conclusive scientific evidence, you cannot read, you can identify that as an industry, but you cannot read exactly how much from that ambient data came from that particular industry because of the mixing that happens in the atmosphere from the stack to where the pollution is measured. And the fact that you might be measuring pollution, I mean, we have measured pollution in Devon that comes from the hydropowered air because of the mixing of air parcels. That's where the complexity comes. That is why you want to make sure that the industry has an emission limit that they must comply with. And not say no, but no, you can't make a contribution in the atmosphere because how? How do you then control a nice area sort of using that is, has mixed and may have come from even other areas. I hope I make that clear then. What is the plan for the department to deal with mining emissions? The minister has published regulations for the control of dust, and those regulations say any person, which covers mining and every other source of dust. And so it empowers the air quality officer in their jurisdiction to require any dust generated, including a mine, to reduce the amount of dust they generate outside their fence. And we have done comprehensive training to authorities on how they will implement those dust control regulations. I think they will go a long way in controlling dust from future disposals, because it's not just for mining, for any person. So even people who construct roads, you know, during the construction of the road, there's a lot of dust that is entrained. They have to comply with those requirements of the dust control regulations. When will the decision of supplements be made public?
Well, now we hear the dust one. Mm. They were of emissions from the mines. On the gases that were took.
Oh, yeah,
because
okay.
There was no mine has applied. But what is our experience on these gases?
Okay. Well, the mine has an atmospheric emission license. That is how they are controlled. We do have ANCOS. They have applied for their smelters for postponement, for PM, for 2015 to 2020. The reason for their application is they are installing a pollution control technology that will enable them to meet the 2020 standards in 2020. So they are able to do a stepwise approach of meeting 2015 and then 2020 expenses. It's better to invest once and meet the final requirement, which is the 2020 standard. So where a mine has a listed activity, they require they will therefore comply with the requirements of that AL. But some of the mines do not have listed activity, so they don't use an AL. They're not operating listed activities. The question around, are you sure what industries, where the industries will comply with what they have committed? I think the law of the land is that we are innocent until proven guilty. So I cannot just based on how a person looks, say, it is like they are lying, they may not be able to comply in the industry. I think the plans are made, we've reviewed the plans. And in fact, if we had a more detailed discussion, some of them, if you look at Total, for example, even the technology has been delivered in South Africa right now. They just need time to install the technology, because you cannot just put it the way you would put a hat on your head. You need, you know, to. So we do have very realistic plans, and we have made requirements where it's possible. If I can make an example of Castle Nitro, where we declined the performance completely. We have to come because there is compliance, and they can pay forward their investment plan. It's another way of constructing another dam. It's not like going to buy a technology in Germany. So we have to look at whether those are reasonable or not. The decisions were made public last week. From the 24th. Yes. They were communicated to the public last week. These decisions that we are talking about on the same day that we attempted to make that presentation to the portfolio. I think that covers all the questions. Oh no, the offset. Who determines the offset? According to the legislation, the National Air Quality Office and the National Authority. But the requirement that we've made is ambient air quality, not the actual offset, which is the approach of the Air Quality Act. The Air Quality Act gives a limit. Your limit is 500. How you bring yourself to compliance with that 500 is up to you. You can buy an FTG, you can operate only 1 hour of the day just to make sure that you comply with the limit. We do not prescribe the how to comply with this, prescribe the limit. This is what you are not to exceed, and then you make the appropriate investment. Thank you.
Yes, well.
Thank you. Just a follow up in terms of your smelters. Sangana, I mean, is known to be one of the largest smelters in the country after Vinuka. And we know in Sangana what is mostly emerged is coal. I just want to check what level are they complying vis-a-vis the fact that they're not applied. I'm talking about now those two, Nuba and Saldana.
Colleagues?
That's the last year.
Yeah, not on top. Mambeba, I wanted to assist all of us that anyone who has not applied is expected to comply. If you have not applied, you must comply. If you don't comply, you go to jail. Because that will be the obvious answer. If you have not applied, they can't do it if you don't comply. If you don't comply, 2015, 1st of April 2015 and 2020, or if you have got a lot of money like Honorable Member Mrapila, you then pay 10 million rand. Or if you are a first offender, 5 million. If you are a repeat offender, 10 million. And I think also the amount. You know, we have seen what happens. It's good that you have raised it. We have seen what happens on broadband rollout. But people are prepared not to stick to the conditions of their license because they are able to pay. The issue is 5 million rands appropriate? Is 10 million rands appropriate? Considering the billions that people make at the expense of the health of our people. I think that is the issue. But I think the question is answered by law. I think this has regarding, you know, members and colleagues from the department, you must know, if we as members have a better understanding, we then become better ambassadors on this matter. And that's why we have allowed the discussion. That's why we sent you begging to go and come with something that, and if we now have a better understanding, and we can speak without notes on this matter now, as we engage with even the industry itself, because we will. That's the commitment we are making in our report. We only met with some parts of Sasol and some parts of little parts of Kenda, Eskom. We would like to meet with industry as a whole, including those who have made the applications, by the way, so that indeed we are assured and we reinforce what you have said to them. That, by the way, we are not representing government now, we are representing the people that send us to Parliament. And they must indeed adhere to the conditions that have been given for these postponements. That's the first issue. The second issue is that the last 20 years made things a little bit simpler today. You know, which is the president who is that, you see, she speaks to people in international fora on all over things. Now she can't say anything that you have got all that understanding, but we are getting there. We are really getting there, and I think on this matter, we can close it now. And thank you very much for the members for the engagement, and the department for the answers. DG, thank you very much. The next issue...
Thank you,
Chair. Thank you. The next issue is we had at some stage some things called Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. And the UN and the various instruments of the UN that deal with sustainable development have now come to... the MDGs come to the end of their term, they have now said that the new sustainable development should still be something that the entire group is still filled with. It's not something that you can open and close, it's not a hat. So we must continue to pursue with matters of development throughout the world, and they have now come with a terminology that speaks to sustainable development goals, SDGs. All that we wanted, colleagues, was just to know where are we in the discourse within the international fora, or the UN international fora, where are we on these matters? That's the first issue. The second issue, where are we as a country? because you see, we don't go somewhere to have discussions, then we come back, as Alf would always do, put those discussions in his cupboard, and we don't implement them, because obviously we would want to benefit from these discussions at international forum. What are the emerging concerns are now on this discourse, and where are we as a country? And thank you very much, DG. The ball is in your court.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Maybe before I just start on the SDGs, just a comment related to the issue of time. One of the ideas that the Minister is taking to Cabinet, which will eventually end up in terms of legislative program, whether it's this year or next year, is the issue of criminal sanction versus administrative sanction. And the criminal sanction procedures are extremely tough procedure to follow, whereas administrative sanctions are generally much easier to handle. It links to the question of the reparation or rehabilitation issue. Where do the funds come from? If we're going to be doing compensation, reparation, rehabilitation kind of things. So this is one of the ideas that the Minister would like to take to Cabinet, and then if accepted, would enter into your legislative program, which kind of links to this issue. And you're only talking air pollution, but there's water, pollution as a whole. Yeah, impact as a whole. So I just thought I'd add that little comment. So it is going to be on your agenda after the Minister has Cabinet approval. Chair, I'm going to ask Chloe to do the presentation because he's much closer to the actual negotiations than I am. Other than to say that the SDGs are only part of the post-2015 development agenda in the UN. So it's not the whole issue. So it's being incorporated into the discussion of the post-2015 development agenda, which is a much broader set of issues. Tom?
Thank you very much, Chair, Honourable Members. Good day. Chair, as you have already rightly pointed that the matter of the SDG has been on the global agenda for quite some time. Last year we had extensive engagement in these meetings, and we have of course engaged with the public around the inputs that they had to provide in the lead up to the General Assembly. I'm going to briefly talk about briefly the outcome on Rio, the working group, how far are we with the working group, the United Nations General Assembly decision that has been taken, briefly highlight as well on the synthesis report by the Secretary General of the United Nations to say what are some of the elements that has been highlighted for consideration as we look into the SDG. I will talk as well about the intergovernmental processes, how do we intend to proceed, and the principles as we have agreed from the previous engagement that will underpin our engagement within on the SDG issue. Just to indicate at front, Chair, that I did not this time around put where we are in terms of the MDG in the country, and I know in the previous engagement we did, we extensively highlighted where we are, and that process has started where the SD of the Statistician General is working on putting the final report on the MDG that will be presented to UNGA come September. So on this presentation, I did not necessarily put a slide around where we are on the MDG. I think one of the main outcomes at Rio was for member states to develop a set of sustainable development goals. So this is just to indicate the SDG process was run out of the Rio process, where it was agreed that the goal should be limited in number, it should be aspirational, and it should be easy to communicate And I thought this was guided by the MDG, the 8 MDG goals, which have seen that they were able to mobilize a country's member states together towards the attainment of sustainable development. Of course, Rio Plus 20 just provided the conceptualization of the SDG and gave a mandate that the SDG should be coherent and be integrated within the UN Development Agenda beyond 2050, as Didi has already alluded, that the SDG is just at one process that will contribute into the post-2015 development agenda, but it's the main process in essence. In the current the United Nations General Assembly, they endorse it as the main basis for the discussion on post-2015 development agenda going forward. And the key emphasis was the need to enhance an integration of the three dimensions of sustainable development, the economic dimension, the social dimension, and the environmental dimension, to ensure that there is mutual support of the three dimensions to attain sustainable development holistically. Well, on this slide, just to indicate that we, of course, had 8 million development goals that were adopted, which, of course, set goals targets for development, which were key for forging global cooperation. And just to indicate that the MDG target date will come to completion come September 2015. That will be the end target date of the MDG, the set of the MDG. And as current, we are waiting on the base document that has been approved by the United Nations General Assembly as the base document to start providing substantive input. We are now going to the weight-by-weight share in terms of what this particular goal means, what does the target mean, and what is it that we think when we now get into the full mode of negotiation should be the country's point of agreement. We are well aware that the working group was established, which of course developed a proposal with 17 goals. The goals encompass 169 targets. And this document was adopted. That's the document that we widely consulted on last time. And it was adopted as the main base.
I think members know that document by heart now.
As the main basis for our engagement. So I think in essence, I'd say we have made great strides within this, because I mean, poverty eradication remains one of the overarching elements for sustainable development. And some of the key issues include ending poverty and hunger, improving health and education, of course, combating climate change as some of the critical elements of this document. Well, in terms of what is happening, I mean, the United Nations General Assembly was more of a political approach to endorse the document as a basis for negotiations, but not necessarily to substantively discuss the issues, because now this document is the basis for negotiations. The negotiations are only starting now, where we will then go there and say, we no longer like this particular goal or we want to change it and phrase it in a particular manner. But generally, the mood within the, in New York, is the developing nations were quite very happy with the basis of the document, because it's more of a pro-development focused document. When you look at the whole issues of having, reducing poverty, the issues of addressing malnutrition, so most developing nations were quite very happy that this is the document that we think we can use as a basis for negotiations. However, developed nations, the North, were not that very supportive, and they had to be behind the scene engagement to push for the document to be endorsed as such. So there were no amendments to the content of the document at the United Nations General Assembly. Well, over and above that, the other document that contributes into this debate is the Sentence Report by the UN General Secretariat. And this Sentence Report is entitled The Road to Dignity by 2030. I think, apologies, I did not circulate that. We can share it even after this meeting to make sure that is additional information that members could have, which focuses largely on ending poverty, transforming all lives, and protecting the planet. I think the pathways within this document is around the whole transformation agenda, which will serve as the input into the process. And this is the input from all UN agencies that contributed to say this is one of the inputs that we are putting to be considered when doing the negotiations. Well, the main aim of the synthesis report was just to support member states with the discussion going forward, just to take stock of the negotiations on the post-2015 and of course to review lessons learned. In that document there are some elements around the lessons learned from the MDGs, how the MDGs were able to mobilize countries to work together towards the attainment of sustainable development, how the MDGs were able to mobilize donor funding resources to shape the policies and strategies of the various countries to drive sustainable development. And of course the report stresses that in fact, even if we go post-2015 development agenda, we need to finish the work that the MDGs has commenced. So this post-2015 should not in any way be isolated to the work that has already been built by the MDGs. Well, those are the six essential elements for the synthesis report. One is around the dignity to end poverty and fight inequality. There's an element around, hence the whole issue of poverty eradication has become one of the overarching objectives of the SDG. Prosperity to grow strong and inclusive transformative economy. And I think this is one of the language, what you put inclusive, where you find that our negotiating partner don't necessarily like. Because when you talk about inclusivity, you are putting in the elements of sharing on the prosperity of the economy, where even a layman on the street will be able to derive benefits. And the argument there was we can no longer use GDP as the only measurement for economic growth. You need to include other elements that will take into consideration the cascading down of the economic growth benefits to ordinary citizens on the ground. There is, of course, an element that around justice to promote safe and peaceful society and strong institutions. And this, of course, given what is happening in the global agenda around the whole issue of peace and security. Partnership to catalyze global solidarity for sustainable development. And there's a goal, and there's an element around the planet to protect our ecosystem for all societies and our children. This largely around the whole issue of natural resource as the base for both economic and social development. And of course there's a whole issue around people to ensure healthy lives, knowledge and the inclusion of women. The whole gender aspect has been built in the synthesis report. So these are some of the elements that the synthesis report has contributed into the process for consideration. In terms of what will be happening going forward, Chair, there is an intergovernmental process that is beginning in January in New York, and they are starting to set up the modality for the negotiations. It's facilitated by Kenya and Ireland, and of course there will be a series of monthly negotiations in the lead up to the summit in September. This process outlines four elements. One is the political declaration. There will be a political declaration come September, and the other one is around the goals and the targets. That's where our document, the 17 goals, will be actually negotiated, the means of implementation, and how are we going to monitor that. Well, there has been preliminary discussion. I think they had two meetings recently just to start fleshing on the declaration. We are yet to receive a formal document which we can then engage with, as we are represented by DECO in New York on the discussion around the political declaration. In terms of our process going forward, honorable member, just to indicate that DECO has established what we call the SDG clusters, which include the social, the economic, the environment, and the social implementation as well as the peace and security. Just to indicate that DECO is the overall lead of our engagement in New York on the post-2015 development agenda, and as a department, we have been given the mandate to facilitate, to co-facilitate with DECO the environmental cluster. We had one meeting with the sector, with the departments that fall within the environmental cluster to start providing substantive input into the goals, and we'll be having another meeting in the coming month to concretize and collate the input to formulate the position that we'll take to DEVO to ensure that by the time we engage on the goals and the targets, we are ready substantively. Over and above that, Chair, given our engagement in Rio and our consultative approach to this matter, we hosted the youth. These are the South African Institute of International Affairs, which is based at the Perth University. Normally, we give them platform to provide input and comments. Last year, in December, they came to the department. They wanted to engage with us. We gladly hosted them, and they provided a substantive document, a declaration, which will form part of the substantive input into the formulation of substantive positions on the SDG. Just to reflect, Chair, on the principles, I think the principle space in terms of what is the principle that will be guiding our engagement on this project. One is to build on the MDGs, and this has been eloquently supported throughout, even within the developing nations, that we still need to build on the MDG going forward. But most importantly, to ensure that the global development agenda should complement both the national and the regional priorities. So in this regard, for us as a country, we'll be guided by the LEP, but from the African region, and given the fact that South Africa is even currently leading the G77, it will be important to draw from the NEPAD and, of course, the strategic document, Agenda 2063 of African Development. The eradication of poverty and hunger, as well as the combating inequality at all levels, has become one of the anchor principle that we'll be pushing at all goals, irrespective of the weighting changes. But I think the essence is we'll be pushing to capture the whole issue of eradication of poverty and hunger as one of the main core areas of focus. The issue of countries having different starting points, different national and regional circumstances is coming quite prominently, and in this regard, the whole principle of common but differentiated responsibility would be one of the anchor principles that will be used in the negotiations. And of course, the emphasis on the balancing and integrating the three-dimensional sustainable development will be one of the guiding principles that will be focusing on. The whole issue of the means of implementation is the area that I think is going to remain quite very contentious, because there's a potential that the developed nations might use this negotiation to renege on the commitment that they've made already. That possibility. Hence, there is a call for a full means of implementation which should be inclusive of the official development assistance. And on this call, there's still an emphasis on the historical obligation and responsibilities of the developing nations to ensure that as we debate and negotiate on the means of implementation, they should not use it as a basis to enact on the commitment for financial assistance for developing nations. In a nutshell, Chair, that is the status where we are globally. We are slowly getting into the mode. I think coming 2 months is going to be crucial in terms of formulating and stemming the substantive details on each and every target and goal to ensure that as we enter into the substantive negotiations, we are ready. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Luckily, I think this committee was able to engage with the SDGs quite comprehensively last year, especially with our public participation processes. So this is all very well. But one of the things that you mentioned to us last year was that South Africa's draft proposal is being considered by the UN to be adopted as the global position. And I just wanted to find out how, you know, whether you've got any feedback on that. I know that you're meeting in September, but I know that everyone was raving about your documents, and I just want to find out. This is all very well, and this presentation basically tells that the negotiations are continuing. So there's not much to know, but I wanted to find out how, you know, is South Africa still leading the way? Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks. Just to ascertain that perhaps the document on the road to dignity by the message will clarify that part. But I'm just saying the MDGs were a 15-year period, 2000 to 2015. Now I take it the sustainable development goals will be 2015 to 2030 or something like that. But I need some confirmation to see when are they ending so that when we have our projection, we know that we are dealing with these up to that particular point. And we are able to assess based on that. That's the one thing, but I'm just saying that's that. But one interesting thing is that I can see that in these negotiations, what is happening in the climate change, it's also having some influence here on the common and differentiated responsibility. So it shows that what the other hand is doing is understood by the other one. So probably we're moving towards a convergence that we'll see the globe moving in the same direction in terms of what we'll need to do. Probably we'll have that easier ways of managing the sustainable ones as well as the other on climate change. Thanks. And the summary is very good. Very, very short and clear, emphasizing the basic ones. Yeah. Thanks.
It is not because of me, I want to go home. That's a short and nice. I think I would agree with members. I'll agree with members. Safe to say that maybe amongst the recommendations, there should be regular updating of the portfolio committee. Of course, when we have made some milestones, we would like to go through the same. When there are milestones and when there are issues that, because indeed, South Africa, through the negotiations, when we go to the UNGA in September, at least we must interact with the South African position as Parliament. So if we can include that as well, so that before the final position of South Africa, based on the 17 goals and 169 target, is concluded, is taken to UNGA, let's look at that and have people, representatives, let's have our view heard on this matter. So that, again, we are also able, by the way, we have a broad mandate from our people. As we interacted with our people agreed with the 17 goals and said that that should form the nucleus of the of South Africa's position in UNGA. So now we still have that mandate for it. So before you go to September, come back so that we don't give you a blank check. Come back so that we have a discussion on those matters. Members, I think, are we done from your side? Can we hear? Yeah, we'll come back to that. Can we take your response?
Thank you very much, Chair. I think you're quite right. We will time and again come and report as we progress and as we undertake our national consultation and as we send the substantive input, we most definitely collate and bring it into the discussion. Just to make mention that the next time when we cover, what we'll do is we'll draw from the substantive input from the economic and the social and other clusters that has been identified by DECO to lead in terms of framing the substantive input for the culture. So we'll draw in all those clusters and put a coherent position together for engagement. On the energy listing, quite correct, and it's not even a coincidence that even our NDP is within that framework. That shows the strong planning process that I think we have in the country as well. You're quite correct, it's going to be 2015 to 2030. On the South Africa strategic leadership, yes, I think the country has indicated that we are also chairing the G7. So our input went into the whole strategic document of chairing the G77 by our DECO department. So we still play quite a strong role
in the international engagement within this space. I think most importantly at this stage that we are chairing the G7 Development Group, and it's going to be quite very crucial that we really need to up the game as well to ensure that this transformation agenda is realized as one of the legacy for the country in sharing G7 at this crucial time within the UN agenda. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if I could just add, this year 2015 is a big year because it's in May is Science for Development Summit in the UN, and then in September is the SDG or the Post 2015 Development Agenda, and then in Paris is the Climate Change Agenda, and all those target dates, end dates, are all 2030. Paris is 2030, financial development is up to 2030, and the SDG. So it's all part of this more coherent, I think, global effort, even though individual processes are moving along. So I just wanted to add to that kind of thing. Honourable Member, on common but differentiated responsibilities, the difference is that in climate change, they added two words, and respective capabilities. And in climate, the and respective capability is all designed to include us in both giving money and taking on obligations. Whereas in the sustainable development debate, those words are missing. The principle is just common but differentiated responsibilities. Nothing about your capability. Just it's a technical negotiation issue, nuance.
Leave that to your negotiators in those global forums or fora. Did you want to say something before we step out of this?
Sure. I thought that we have responded, and basically, I think also I wanted to be more direct in the response, but our report, our document, our proposal has not been adopted, but using it to influence, I think that is the response. And what we're also not certain about the department, whether they are going to be a broader parliamentary debate at times, the way those engagements with the other key clusters in the sector of sustainable development, like climate change, so that we are then prepared. But of course, normally it's not us, it's yourself and the minister and the deputy minister that in each, but we can help with the preparation. Thanks.
In terms of that's what I was going to comment on as we close the discussion of the matter, that maybe as you come to us, it must be some sort of a joint, because this matter is a matter that is undertaken by various clusters. So perhaps you have mentioned DERCO. You have mentioned, I think, social transformation is part of the finance and economic transformation. So we might have to find the other portfolio committees that have a bite on this, so that when we then have a discussion, we have a discussion as a group, then we also decide how to take it forward. It could make sense that the South African position going to UNGA is debated in Parliament. It would make sense that here are issues. And again, just to also bring this to the attention of the South African populace, of where are we? The only way is to have it debated in Parliament. But it's something that we will be consulting on in the various portfolio committees on the way forward. But colleagues, thank you very much, DG, and your team on these matters. We are quite good. But again, I think what is also very inspiring is that these you work with people who know what they are doing. That's very inspiring. They know what they are talking about, they know what they are doing, and indeed they are people that are an asset to our country. Then let's keep them there. Let's not fire them tomorrow. Because we need this expertise so that we, as well as members of parliament, through engagement with them, we can be better members of parliament. And I can tell you, we are far better than the first day when we met with you last year after elections. We are far better. We are able to engage on these at times very technical matters, but we are happy that we don't embark even on debates. And by the way, members, our report on air pollution hotspots visit is coming in next week in the House. So again, it's good that we talked about some of the things, because I know that among other things that we are raising in the report is compensation to our people by polluters. How do we build an environment? Indeed, the discussion here has been helpful. It's been very helpful. How do we create an environment that moves towards our people being compensated? And again, should thank you for the health studies that you are undertaking in the valley. Because I think there are many lessons that we will learn. When is it supposed to be available? End of April. We should have a sense, what are the scientific health impacts on our people in all those areas, Zambela, Bukene, etc., where the study is focused. And therefore, we are then able to practically say, what is our response? What is our response? So, colleagues and teachers, thank you very much. You are now allowed to go home. Wherever it is you are going, I don't know where you are going. Members, we still have one. They'd like him to dispense off. Thank you, GC, and your team. We are told that that outside, probably we'll find you outside, because I don't think that will be home. By the way, we can't have wasteful expenditure or fruitless. It's the land outside. Members, just one last item. There is the minutes of our last meeting before you, and I'll be referring to the first page if there's any matter.
Chair, I've been through them, and I'm not sure whether Honourable Mkutama Masi Mart is absent or whether his name is just not be there at all, because I think in the meeting it was announced that the Honourable Marapela was going to be replacing him, so I'm not sure whether he should be recorded as absent or not at all. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, we are talking about minutes. That now those minutes, at the time when we sat, we expected the meeting when it started to happen with him. But in this meeting, we now know that there's been a replacement. So for this meeting, there will be no reflection of an absence with him. Because indeed, you see, we are just acting on the basis of what has come to us. It came to us during the meeting, and therefore that's why we are saying at the time of the start of the meeting there was no apology from the time on. And obviously the way of dealing with such a matter is absent. But now, since the EFF has told us that he will no longer be part of this, he will no longer be reflected in any of our meetings. No, it's that last meeting. Yeah. That's the first page. Second page, any matter?
Oh, Morapela.
Yeah. No, he's saying that, no, I'm explaining the logic. I'm just explaining the logic of how the name of Rikama comes in there. It should not be there again. Second page, page. I think that you have read it. Colin? That page. Good. Fourth page. They say we are very good at shorthand. Do you shorthand? Yeah. Fifth page. Thank you. Any more? Gagana?
For the adoption of the
Any Gagana? Very much. Colleagues, this meeting is adjourned. By the way, we are not meeting next Friday. Next Friday. Because the department does not have any pieces of legislation. Therefore, on Tuesday, we will not give it any legislation because there's none. So they will then, we will bring forward the matter we're supposed to deal with on Friday, the 13th. Therefore, on Friday the 13th, because we will be money by bread, we can go home. So thank you very much, colleagues. We can learn it and go home. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't know. Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye. Oh, God, you can't be talking to me. Oh,